listening to BuddhistGeeks.com. February 5th, 2007, Episode 5, Phil Stanley, We're Not the Cheerleaders of Buddhism. In this episode, Phil Stanley discusses Buddhist lifestyles in the West and how our approach and practice differs from traditional Eastern practitioners. He addresses our relationships to retreats and monasticism, as well as the difficulties Westerners face in finding a livelihood that supports practice. Phil also discusses controversy over what constitutes a legitimate lineage and teacher. This is part two of a three-part series. If you're interested in sponsoring our podcast, please visit www.buddhistgeeks.com/advertise. What lifestyles of Buddhist practice have emerged here in the West, or will emerge? Because it seems as though we approach practice differently, not necessarily fundamentally, but in different ways than maybe has happened in the past in traditional Asian Buddhism. So what things have you noticed in terms of lifestyles? And maybe you could briefly mention again those three paradigms that Reggie Ray uses, because that's, I think, a very helpful reference.
Right. Well, the reference point here is that the classic early Western understanding of the paradigms in Buddhist for Buddhists were a twofold. One was the laity and the monastic community, and the laity supported the monastic community and, you know, giving donations to support them, getting good rebirth, you know, getting good merit that affords them good rebirths in their future life. And the monks, for their part, are supposed to, there are a number of things they do, ideally they're getting realized, support to getting realized. They learn texts, they preserve texts, they practice and meditate, they lead virtuous lives, they accumulate merit themselves, they teach the lay people, and so forth. So you have this sort of simple two-pole model. Reggie's work, Buddhist Saints in India, was useful in pointing out that there are always monks are, in fact, in the time of the Buddha, it's quite clear that there were lay people doing this too, really pursuing realization itself. And often this involved intensive practice, which monastic life didn't necessarily support as much as they would like, so they would go off, whether that's caves or mountains or whatever, forests. And in India, going to the forest in that time, day and age, was a dangerous thing. You know, they had a real idea that there was the village and the, you know, civilized, quote, civilized areas and the forest. You know, it was dangerous. So these were courageous and determined individuals going off to practice. So there is this idea that some people who want to get realized will have to do things that don't quite fit into normal social structures and go off. In the West, we clearly, the model of the layperson doesn't fit. We're not interested in being the cheerleaders for the, you know, the athletes on the field who are the monks. You know, we want to do it ourselves. And so we want to do the retreats, we want to do the home practice and the study and so forth ourselves. So it's very different. In Tibet, this happened too. You had the Nakpas we mentioned earlier, you know, lay people who were not monks, who were dedicated to their practice, known by the community. They also had their own dress. They were, you know, observable, identifiable within the Tibetan culture, and this is one of the things we don't have. Christianity has this issue as well. You know, if you're an Episcopal priest or a Catholic priest, you wear, you know, distinguishable robes, but most Protestants don't have any method of distinguishing a preacher from anybody else. And we have this sort of issue in the West. A lot of people called lamas, you know, people, Westerners have done three-year retreat. Right. Sometimes their masters, their Tibetan masters will say, well, you should wear some distinctive garb, but it doesn't really work too well. Go around in robes as a layperson going to your job at the so-and-so corporation or whatever it is. So most of the three-year retreatants don't do this. There's no visual way of distinguishing them.
In monasticism, that doesn't seem to be something that's having deep roots here. I mean, there are Westerners who are taking monastic vows, but I wonder how that's going to play out. And that certainly relates to the whole issue of, will we just be lay practitioners supporting monastics when we don't really have that? Mm-hmm. It seems like we're more leaning to some kind of combination of a lay yogin or forced, part-time forced renunciate of sorts.
Well, life is so complex for the Westerners, you know, just right. Having households that have interior plumbing, and, right. You know, cable systems and telephone systems, and the cost of just having a household is much harder here. Mm-hmm. So there's more difficult to have a simple life, at least we think it is. Uh-huh. You know? in terms of the monastic thing, it has been the case that monasticism has been the repository of Buddhism, and that which has transmitted it and kept it alive for in a major portion throughout its history. So it's my own feeling and hope that the monastic tradition itself does continue in the West, and that it contribute to the development of Buddhism in the West. You have people, it gives you the wherewithal to really devote yourself to promoting, studying, practicing, and teaching. So you would hope that it could produce people who would really support the spread and maturing of Buddhism. That said, it seems unlikely that it'll be anywhere near as important as it was in Asia. There are difficulties. The monastics, there is a tendency for them to not stick with it. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. Acharya Lama Denpa Gyaltsen, he's done his three-year retreat as well as finishing Shedra at Rumtek Monastery, talks about renunciation as it's not a sort of denial of something for oneself. It's like it's not this hardship that you're denying this thing you deeply want. The example he gave was, if you're a kid, you may be fixated on your toys, but when you grow up, you stop having interest in the toys. It's not like a big painful thing to not play with your toys anymore. you just don't play with the action figures anymore, or whatever it is. You just don't do it. It's not this big denial that you've grown out of it. So there's a quality that there's an understanding of renunciation that's more of a mature thing, where you're drawn to do something rather than you're painfully not doing something. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a way in which we could understand monasticism in a much more mature way than we do now.
Right. So one thing I've noticed is that Western practitioners take up yearly retreats. They'll go on a month retreat every mm-hmm. year. Mm-hmm. They'll maybe go study, for example, Natarta and do study Shedra.
Mm-hmm. For a month.
Yeah, for a month. And so that seems to be a pretty important part of Western Buddhist practice.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts about that aspect of practice, or that version of a practitioner?
Well, Kenpo Tsuchim Gyamsa Rinpoche is not, apparently, I haven't heard this directly myself, but I've heard this through students of his, that he's not that keen on three-year retreat.
Uh-huh.
He's keen on intensive retreat practices, like go do your month, go do 3 months,
uh-huh.
but come out and have a life and deal with regular world, deal with conduct at the ordinary level. So there's some idea of really having this intent, motivation, and aspiration to practice and transform oneself, one's state of mind. And the results of three-year retreat are quite mixed, I would say. That a good number of people have gone in and out now, and it's not like they're suddenly enlightened from doing that.
Uh-huh.
It's not an end-all and be-all. And in fact, it's become clear that in the Tibetan culture, three-year retreat it was like professional training, that you became a ritual specialist that knew how to do all these different things, and then you could actually make a livelihood if you were, suitably talented at it and add the motivation or whatever, that you had a role in Tibetan society, that you could do ritual things to benefit people according to the, if someone's sick, going to do practices for them or something like that. And then there's a whole cultural side to that, and do Westerners believe in such practice?
Right.
There's a whole separate thing. So there's this whole dimension to the background of three-year retreat in this Tibetan culture that doesn't seem applicable to us.
Uh-huh.
We view it as a personal transformation. It's a space where you intensively work on transforming yourself,
right,
and uprooting your neurosis, and discovering and unveiling your wisdom and compassion and so forth. And in some ways, we're a bit idealistic about the three-year practice compared to how it actually functioned in the Tibet. Which isn't to say that the Tibetans didn't use it that way, didn't relate to it that way,
right,
as a personal transformative thing either. But
there's another dimension to it.
Yeah, other cultural, economic dimensions, social dimensions, uh-huh. and status and stuff that are less at play for us. Now, it's not that we won't develop those dimensions. Yeah. In fact, there's a whole issue about how can people who are really devoted to Buddhism make a livelihood.
Right.
Tibetan culture produced ways of doing that. you know, whether you're a village ritualist or you're a famous teacher and realized person who gets students, whether you're a layperson or monastic or whatever, there was a culture of giving and supplicating and, right. you know, paying for teachings and stuff like this, which we don't have. And, myself being a professor at a university, to get paid to teach Buddhism is a really rare thing to be able to do that. And other people trying to develop themselves as teachers, there are not that many Surya Dasas in the world, right? Or Reggie Ray is himself in this transition now too. And we absolutely need Westerners to become teachers.
Yes.
You know, and that's not saying, you know, one person's great or not. I mean, it's not even a statement about whether some, you know, individual should be doing it or not. It's just we need it to be done. So from that point of view, the Surya Dasas, and there's controversies about his lineage, and Reggie, and there's controversies about him breaking from the
right.
Sakya and stuff like this. So there's all those things, and this happened in Tibet too. Tartong Tulku is not a tulku. He named himself a tulku. He's got a really interesting history. I knew someone, a Tibetan, who he was at Sarnath, and he decided to get married. And he invited all these different monasteries, and he said he was, you know, was they were going to do prayers and pujas. Didn't tell him he was getting married. And then suddenly they find all these monks are there. They think they're doing this sort of, you know, meritorious puja, reciting all these texts and stuff, and he's funding it and all this stuff. And the next thing they know, she's up there in front of him getting married, and then being photographed with all the monks as if the monks were you know, all coming there for the marriage. You know, so he's got a very unconventional life. I'm not you know, sort of judging anything.
Right.
I'm just describing it here. You know? And he declared himself a tulku. He was trying to get, I heard through Tibetans, that he was supplicating to be recognized as a tulku, and it never happened. So he just started calling himself a tulku, and he comes to the West.
Yeah.
And again, he's done, you know, he's published all sorts of texts. He's given to monasteries all over Asia major texts. You know, is he a tulku? Well, you know, I don't know, but... So there's a lot of just unusual lineages. You know, the Dunhuang Caves, where they opened up these caves at the end of the Silk Route journey over, you know, goes over from India over the north of Tibet and through the deserts north of the Himalayas, and it ends up in China, the Silk Route. There's this famous town at the eastern end, the Chinese end, where the southern and northern routes, so there's one going over the top of the desert and one going over the bottom of the desert, and they connect back at Dunhuang, close to India. So a very powerful city economically, and there were monasteries there, and they sealed all these caves up with sacred trash, someone has called it. You know, the books would get worn out, the texts would get worn out, and they stuff them in these caves, and they seal them. It's a desert. They're still there, you know. They've survived. Well, some of them are Chinese, different languages, Tibetan, all this stuff. And they have some early Chan records, and they do not agree with the lineage records that the later Chan tradition thinks is their lineage.
Hmm.
So there's this whole controversy now,
right.
that it doesn't seem like the lineages that the, you know, modern lines that have survived claim to have gone back. These early sources don't collaborate, that they're some of the figures are not in there at all. So this issue of what's a legitimate lineage is, in some ways, it's a red herring in some way, because the tradition is always, it's not that linear necessarily.
Right.
You see, so if someone like Reggie wants to say, I'm ready to be a teacher,
uh-huh.
and he hasn't had the Sakyong say, yes, you are, or Trungpa Rinpoche say, yes, you are,
uh-huh.
well, that's somewhat how this goes.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's not to say, I mean, Reggie's thing might flourish 100 years from now. He may be the, you know, and the Shambhala may disappear. Who knows?
Right.
I'm not arguing for any of it. I'm just describing
right.
it. And it may die out, you know. Reggie, who's Reggie, you know, 100 years from now? You just never know how it flourishes.
Right.
So things are, it's much more of a Wild West than we think.
This has been a presentation of BuddhistGeeks.com, copyright 2007. Music in this podcast provided by Seed for Chaos. For more great music and writing, visit his blog at www.seedforchaos.com.